Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us today is my good friend, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm, Capital Alpha Partners, who joins us to give us his view of the week ahead and what's on his mind. Byron, Happy New Year, and thanks very much for joining us.
Good. Happy New Year to you and your listeners, Vago.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Couple of great notes on your part. One on the uncertainty surrounding the defense budget, given the change in administration and the somewhat chaotic way that we're going through this process. And then you had a note on an unlikely but possible hypothetical bear case for defense. Let's start with the unprecedented series of events. You're somebody who blends strategy, international relations with industrial affairs. So it's kind of a unique intersection that you sit at. It's been an unprecedented series of events over the past days. We have several hundred Republican senators and congressmen banding together to invalidate a legitimate certified election. The president made a call to Georgia officials to change election tallies to grant him the state. And that appears, or other events appear, to have propelled 10 surviving defense secretaries to warn of the importance of accepting the result of the election and a warning against the use of military force or the military to change election outcomes. What is the international impact of all of this chaos that Susan Glaser of The New Yorker has called the Trumper Dameron?
Putting the domestic political angle to this aside, it's got a weigh on how other countries view the United States. I mean, this is, I still fully expect that on January 20th, you know, we're going to see Biden inaugurated and we're going to push on from this. But, you know, the precedent is really unique. I mean, you tell me what European country has had to have 10 former defense ministers warn against military intervention. You know, it's remarkable. And I suppose, you know, some of these factors that have existed, they're not going to go away on January 20th or 21st. As a matter of fact, this is going to be a very interesting week in Washington, D.C. to see how it all plays out on January 6th and what's going to happen in the city. So I think the bigger question really is, how will this weigh on the confidence that other countries view the United States and its ability to kind of remain on a track that the Biden administration wants to realign U.S. And international engagement on.
And ultimately, right, the failure to address the pandemic also plays into that, right? Because the Chinese narrative is, look, democracies are the ones who've been badly plagued by this. Even though the virus began in Wuhan, we isolated quickly. We put a testing regime in. We did contact tracing. And so ultimately we defeated the virus. And so we're posting economic growth, right? I mean, so in this time of a contest of ideas, you have Beijing taking advantage of each and every single one of these elements to advance its case that, you know, if anything, democracies in us are not just equal, look at the problems they have, but actually we're superior.
So I would commend to people an essay that was written by Dan Wang. He's basically an investment analyst who lives in Beijing as part of another firm, but he posts a kind of an annual review each year. His 2020 letter was posted on January 1st, and I think it's a very interesting and sober assessment of China, how China's weathered this thing, you know, what Xi is really trying to do. And I think, you know, one of the takeaways is don't think that China is some, you know, brittle colossus that's about to collapse, that this is just some Potemkin village, that, you know, he points from his very personal experience about how kind of some of the fundamental things in the day-to-day life of a lot of Chinese have improved. And you know, this is going to be one of the key themes that's going to continue to play through 2021 and beyond, this competition between the United States and like-minded countries and what China and other countries are trying to offer Russia as well, you know, an alternative way of doing things. And I just don't think that the incompetence, even with the vaccine rollout, you're seeing it not just in the United States, France. I saw this morning, I think only had 520 or 600 vaccinations completed. So it really will be an issue, particularly, you know, as this new strain of COVID-19 plays out. And I think, a lot of countries are going to be looking at just how well their governments perform and are there other models that are out there? So we're in a real competition. We all know that, but it's worth reiterating on the fourth day of the new year.
It would have been better had folks recognized the importance of actually having concerted leadership to fight the pandemic from the beginning, as opposed to disinforming, right? Again, I mean, the Chinese model, you don't want to emulate anything from an authoritarian state, but at the end of the day, was it better to have a shorter span, harder lockdown, as opposed to constantly making this debate about, well, you know, we can't lock down and we have to have freedom and we need to maintain our businesses. And that just prolongs the economic impact. Right. As opposed to having a more concerted, painful drop, then you would have gotten more V-shape, wouldn't you have?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, some places, you know, New Zealand, Taiwan, South Korea, are all doing relatively well. So there are going to be lessons learned from this. But it just goes back to kind of the fundamental state of play in the United States this week and really up through the inauguration. And as I said, this isn't going to go away on January 20th. The beliefs, the views, the attitudes, it's still a small minority, but it really has some interesting setups for both the 2022 elections and the 2024 election in the United States.
Well, we're certainly going to see what happens tomorrow in Georgia. And we should point out, right, Joe Biden's number one priority is to fight the pandemic at home, also abroad, while also figuring out ways to both stand up to China and Russia while also cooperating with them. Obviously, the president-elect's team saying it's possible to be tough on China, for example, tough on Russia for what it just did, while at the same time negotiating or extending the START agreement, noting that throughout history, you know, we've been able to cooperate while also competing. And then, of course, you have China that has struck trade deals with the EU and Asian countries and saying to the Biden administration, there is a small window to sort of reset relations. As news organizations have written to sort of box the administration in. I have a kind of a two-part question. First, because of the political discord, right? I mean, 10 million more people voted for Donald Trump in 2020 than voted for him in 2016. So that shows that there's traction for his ideas and his popularity. He intends to maintain the megaphone, which is why hundreds of members of Congress are doing what could potentially be seen as a treasonous action in order to appease the leader of their party, whose blessing they want for their future political races, whether they choose to stay in Congress or seek a higher office. Do you think that the pandemic battle is any different? I mean, are these members who have rejected mask wearing and contributed to some of these conspiracy theories, do you think going to pivot and apply the sort of, you know, accept whatever the Biden administration does in order to fight the pandemic?
No. I mean, that's where I think we're in for, you know, a pretty tough year or two. I don't see people, you know, I mean, we read about all of us, you know, state legislatures, legislative members who oppose mask wearing, who died of COVID-19, you know, and that doesn't seem to really bear on kind of a 180 degree shift or turn in some of this. So it might get winnowed down at the margin, but it's really kind of a deep-seated ideological divide that I think this mask pushback and vaccine pushback, you know, it's a manifestation of a whole nother range of core social beliefs. And I don't know how that really changes. I mean, maybe it evolves over time, but it's a really interesting phenomena. And to a degree, it's not just the United States. You know, you look at like the rise of QAnon in Europe. Again, these are still small minorities of the total population, but they're small and vocal, and they get visibility. You know, that's why I keep pointing. I think January 6th in Washington, D.C. is going to be real interesting to see how that's covered and what comes of that.
The second question is, do you think that China's trade deals with the EU and other Asian nations are going to hamstring the Biden administration's effort to bring democracies on the same page to hold China to account for its bad behavior and worrying vector?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the EU agreement with China, you know, this has been apparent for a while. There are really different views between the United States and the EU about China and its intents and what it really represents. So that's been existing for a while. It's going to be fascinating to see how the Biden administration tries to thread or weave through this. And again, you know, you're going to have a very vocal minority for now that's going to be pushing for even more stringent moves on China. So, you know, just the fundamental aspect of trying to get any kind of trade deal or agreement, if that's where we go with China, through, you know, Biden can rely and probably will just rely on executive action, executive orders. But the idea that Congress is going to somehow become compliant in this whole process, no, that's not going to happen. To Iran, I think you're going to have someone talking about this shortly, will be another real friction point. Where a lot of these different views, really fundamentally different views, are going to get manifest.
Ilan Berman is going to join us later in the week to talk about Iran and where we are. And Randy Shriver and Patrick Cronin will be joining us as well to talk about how the Biden administration needs to approach China at this watershed moment, because there is this concern that everybody will want to just go back to normal. The Biden team has stressed that that's not going to be the case, but there is a worry, for example, among some strategists that will be more eager, for example, to strike a climate deal, which is something that's important to us, but actually not all that important to China. So China gets a big pass on what it views to be important.
The thing I'll add, Vago, because I think, you know, this has come out in some of the opinion polls. I don't think you see, you know, in countries like the Philippines, which arguably is a battle zone in the Indo-Pacific. I mean, it's just fundamental to U.S. strategy in the Western Pacific and the whole security of Northern Asia. You know, what you see is still more admiration for the United States, but increasingly more respect for China. So it's not as if there's been this massive public opinion shift where Filipinos want to think about immigrating to China or you know, inviting Confucius Institutes to come in and set up, you know, a network in the Philippines. But I think it's that respect attitude. And I think more importantly, it's kind of like, well, if you have more respect for China and you start to worry about what the stability is of the United States, you know, which side are you going to butter your bread? And I think history would suggest that, you know, You want to have that respect and authority where people aren't going to waver when the big asks come or when the, you know, when something dramatic happens in the region that you know, the U.S. absolutely is going to need access to the Philippines in some broader campaign or conflict, an era of heightened tensions to keep China kind of boxed in that region.
But again, going back to the top of the conversation, that goes because we, as the world's oldest democracy, had a degree of political stability, right, that served and undergirded our legitimate position as a world leader. Whereas when most of the American political discourse has devolved into kookery, then it makes it a lot easier not to take the United States seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, one of the factors, Vago, you know, when you think about the Philippines, is you saw probably a week or so ago the Filipino president basically state that he would not renew or he would suspend the U.S. Visiting Forces Agreement that's been in place with the Philippines, and if they didn't get vaccines. So there's more and more of that play where, you know, in a different era, I don't think anybody would make be making those kind of threats because, A, they'd have the confidence that maybe they will get U.S. help and assistance. And why put at jeopardy something that potentially could be very important, that is important for the ongoing security of the Philippines and, frankly, the whole Indo-Pacific region?
I want to get to your note on the bear case for defense that you made in one of your pieces, right? I mean, so the good news is the National Defense Authorization Act is on, right? But both House and Senate overrode President Trump's veto. So that's positive. But there's still a degree of uncertainty about where the budget stands fundamentally. Obviously, Team Biden has complained that they're not getting the transition support. And even Republican friends of mine make abundantly clear there's been very little cooperation from the part of the department. Indeed, there is an expectation of if you will, a Martin Luther King Jr. Weekend massacre where the last of the political appointees are all sent adrift to further complicate transition efforts. You know, give us your sense on what that, what was interesting about the NDAA now that it's passed, because you did a reflection on what you thought were some interesting elements, but then what's the bear case for defense going forward, given the consensus is that spending stays flat? The question is how much inflation adjustment goes into that, right? So it's flat or declining slightly, as we've already seen it decline from $750 billion last year to $740 this year.
Okay, well, the genesis for this piece was, you know, it was kind of spitballing or noodling on what could change in 2021 and beyond. And I think, you know, I talked about it previously. It's fairly unique that defense stocks underperform. Most defense stocks underperform the market in 2020. You know, the old saw is anybody who looked back at history, large U.S. defense stocks tended to outperform the market in a presidential election year. And there's some good reasons for that. But I think the point is, you know, the fundamentals of the group were actually pretty good. I mean, no one had major negative surprises. Yeah, there were some minor disruptions from COVID-19, but I mean, nothing akin to what was going on in commercial aerospace, the airlines, cruise line industry, anything like that. So the fundamentals were really okay. What I was trying to get at is, okay, here are some hypotheticals. You know, what could really worsen the fundamental outlook for this group in 2021 and beyond? And, I just kind of ticking these things off, I think clearly, you know, if we go back to the kind of budget standoff that emerged over raising the debt ceiling, that the current debt ceiling has been suspended until August 1st, 2021. That was part of the 2019 budget deal. I absolutely expect, you know, we're going to see debt and deficit discussions come roaring back. So one setup is kind of what we saw around the Budget Control Act when that was implemented in 2011. You know, is defense spending held hostage to some kind of broader deal, and we're back to sequestration, you know, spending cuts that really are driven not by what defense needs, but by this broader tension between defense and non-defense spending and debt and deficit. So that's one angle. Another point, you know, there's a view in the market that we're about to see the return of the roaring 20s, that, you know, after the pandemic, you know, all these wonderful things that are happening with technology, there's pent-up savings, that it could really be a great decade. I frankly think that's a lot of Wall Street hype. But, you know, if we do get into that kind of environment and you're back to very low unemployment rates, there's, you know, surge in things like housing construction, domestic energy production, the Biden administration gets a major bill through to up U.S. fundamental research development spending, government spending, you know, does that then start to create the kind of risk for defense contractors that have emerged in prior eras where there's been inflation, where they just can't get the people, the quality people to execute on some of the work that's expected of them? There are metrics, not metrics, measures in contracts that would allow some blow off if material prices rose, but it's the people side that I worry about.
And it, because ultimately it's always about the people.
Right. you know, the other two I mentioned is just a major break with the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and some of the other Gulf states. You know, that's really going to depend on the vector the Biden administration takes on human rights. You know, how hard are they going to try and rebalance in the Middle East? You know, what's going to be the behavior of Saudi Arabia and UAE in the region? And, you know, could you see this pivot away from the U.S. as a preferred arms supplier to China and Russia, which I think they'd be more than happy to do? So that's a risk that would have an impact on some of the exports the U.S. is making to the region. And the final one was just, we really don't know what DOD industrial policy is going to be, and more broadly, how this administration, this new administration, is going to approach kind of attitudes towards industry concentration, mergers and acquisitions. You know, the template here is when Jock Gonsler came in and, you know, shot down the Lockheed Martin Northrop Grumman deal in 1997. You know, that's the sort of precedent that, you know, could you see changed attitudes towards the power of large defense contractors in the U.S. market? We had a near scare in 2018 over progress payment rules. Different people may have different views about, you know, the financial prowess of these companies and their stability compared to other sectors. And like, hey, maybe you ought to be taking a little bit more risk, and maybe you ought to be using your cash flow for internal investment, not just buying stock back. So those are the sort of risks. I don't think they're on the table now, but it's just something to think about.
You just briefly want to get your take on the distributed ops and archipelagic defense piece that you wrote. What were your key takeaways?
Look, it's just something I've been noodling on for a while. And it was the notion that, you know, it was kind of triggered by, you know, finally seeing the 30-year Navy plan, some of the smaller ships, the smaller amphibs that were in that plan. And, you know, the Marines have been talking about this, and Navy have been talking about distributed operations and archipelagic defense. And I guess the fundamental questions that I would have, it kind of goes back to the discussion on the Philippines or Indonesia, for that matter. That's where the archipelagos are. You know, if you look at a marine chart, map doesn't always capture the depths in some of these choke points. You know, they're really some very narrow sea lanes that, if you control those, you can keep people out of the South China Sea, but you can also keep people from, you know, getting into the South China Sea. So I think the questions that I would ask are, you know, that whole concept of distributed operations, smaller ships, kind of smaller size marine units and possibly army units conducting strike against surface vessels or even targets in China, maybe even getting engaged in ASW work. You know, can that really work? Can those units really hide in plain sight in a world where we have not just overhead assets, but a lot of people with smartphones that are pretty quick to post this stuff on social media, or better yet, you know, can funnel those people who might be interested, funnel that information, that imagery to people who might want to target it. That was one concept. I think the other concept was, you know, it really goes back to history and looking at Operation Causeway, which was a U.S. plan to recap or take Formosa from the Japanese, and just the size of the invasion force. I still think it's a fairly daunting task for China, but you'd really have to think differently. I don't think that archipelagic defense concept really works when you think about reinforcing Taiwan, potentially in a semi-contested air space in and around Taiwan. You really have to look at, you know, the UK efforts during World War II to resupply Malta, for example.
Real quick, give us your sense on the week ahead, but also the 2021 calendar that I think is still more wishful thinking than reality maybe. And,
you know, there's really not a lot going on. You know, we still have this transition, kind of have to watch for how that plays out. Brookings is having an event on artificial intelligence that might be interesting. And then on Friday, Tom Carrico at CSIS is doing an event on kind of counter UAS views, plans, programs at the Department of Defense. And it's another issue that I think it's good to see it aired. I do think that the use of Turkish drones, for example, in the recent conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and then in Libya, you know, these are just, that alarm bell has been ringing for a while. And I recommend as a background read to this Friday event, a paper that Uzi Rubin wrote back in June titled Israel and the Precision Guided Missile Threat. And, you know, what he basically says is, look, we're in a different era now. I mean, these things really are capable. You know, air power kind of carried the day, even for the Israelis in 1967 and 82 against Syria. But the capability of these precision guided weapons, he was not specific in what he really meant, but I would include the drones, the kind of low and slow stuff that is a problem for air defense systems. You know, his point is these inventories really can be war winners. You couldn't make that in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s unless they were maybe nuclear weapons. But it's a good background read for, I think, the problem the U.S. and other countries are going to confront.
And before we go, Byron, the 21 calendar?
It's different this year because of, you know, you're going to have a normal delay in a detailed budget submission with any new administration. I think the key is don't expect a lot of budget news flow in kind of the usual, you know, first Monday of February. I think, you know, to really see the details come out, it's probably going to be more in an April, May timeframe. That'll give enough time for kind of a quick congressional review. This is on the FY22 budget, whatever amendments or changes the Biden administration wants to make to this. So the whole budget cycle kind of gets pushed out, and it's not even clear whether this there'll be enough time to really build the FY23 to 26 numbers. That may have to wait until the FY23 POM, and we'll tack on 27 to that 2027. There are a number of trade shows that are still planned. A lot of these are virtual. You know, the one that's, you know, at bat next week is going to be Surface Navy Association in Washington, D.C. That'll be a virtual event. Some of the others have been pushed out, and it's not clear whether they're going to be live or virtual. So, you know, there'll be a fairly steady flow, although, you know, we won't be bumping at each other on the the floor of some of these events in Huntsville or the Gaylord Center in Maryland. At least I don't expect to be doing that through the summer. And then the last point was just some of the geopolitical events that I think will matter to defense. Besides the U.S., you have elections in Iraq for their parliament, and then Iran for their president in June. And then the September election in Germany, I think, you know, they're kind of shaping events that also people ought to just kind of keep an eye on how this plays out. You know, do you get hardliners in Iran? You know, is there a kind of a rapprochement between the United States? What happens in the Middle East is still going to be critical to what happens for U.S. defense spending. And the German election, I think, will really be telling as to, you know, where Europe is going to go in their security views and their defense spending plans. So,
Byron, thanks very much. Always a pleasure having you on. Looking forward to having you back on again on Friday.
Thanks, Fargo.